So my name is Stan Weiss. I'm a professor of preventive medicine and community health and of quantitative methods at the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey on its Newark campus. I told you a little bit about the Joint Policy Committee of the Societies of Epidemiology in the introduction. And I'm very glad that the APHA has allowed the JPC to be here again and have this symposium. I'm going to talk a little bit about causality issues and try to tie it in a little bit to what you know and what you don't know about global health and how things are evolving. Causality. All of you, I'm sure, have heard of Koch's postulates. They've served us very well, I think, when we were dealing with the era of infectious agents, and then we thought they were basically bacterial, fungal. There are things we could plate out, we could look at under the microscope, and we thought that we could pinpoint them if they caused a single acute disease and understand them. And there's no question that Koch was one of the great epidemiologists of his time, in our time, in guiding our way. And the four essential aspects were that the etiologic microbe could be found in every instance of a disease, that this microbe should not be found in subjects without disease, showing specificity, that the microbe should be isolated in pure culture on lifeless media and be capable of causing the characteristic disease upon new inoculation in a susceptible host, and it could re-isolate it from the host. So this fails currently when we deal with more complex phenomena, such as multifactorial disease, illnesses with stepwise development, viruses or novel infectious agents. A virus you can't plate there. There's tremendous variation in viruses, sometimes between species. You can't even cultivate a virus in a different species. And you're not going to introduce a pathogenic virus into someone as your experiment to induce disease. Sometimes we've done it inadvertently. With HIV, we actually have fulfilled that aspect of Koch's postulates, for instance, in our healthcare workers who have needle sticks, who had no risk factors, who could prove that they didn't have beforehand because of stored sera and the evidence of the HIV virus, and then we have an incident and show that they're infected, and unfortunately some of those people have progressed and even died from the disease. Fortunately, it's extremely rare, but that helps fulfill the issue. We have people who have argued that HIV is not the cause of AIDS, because it doesn't fulfill Koch's postulates. Well, first, I don't think they fully understand how you need to evolve over time and apply things, and that indeed, even if you stretch the postulates, it does start off applied. So some of the problems, in summary, with Koch's postulates are that it ignores the contribution of host, vector, and environment to disease susceptibility and response. There are issues of colonization state. There are people who may have a pathogen and not succumb to it. We know that there's tremendous genetic variation in susceptibility to different things. We don't fully understand those things yet, but clearly you don't have to have a situation where only those who develop disease are the only ones to have that pathogen. Many pathogens can't be propagated on lifeless cell-free medium in the lab, so these can't possibly fill his third postulate. Examples are viruses, many parasites, uncultivated bacteria, and you'll see a little bit later in the lecture we have things we've now learned exist through PCR, and we have probably no hope that we're ever going to culture them. In fact, if you think of something about flora in your body and think of a coral reef, there are probably organisms there which give you the structure and body on which other organisms then can live. And you have this whole colony of different organisms living in symbiosis. It's going to be a while till we understand some of that. So we don't consider, under Koch's postulates, the possibility of disease produced by a microbial community rather than a single pathogen. And most microbes do not exist in nature as a pure culture. When you think about your own bodies, do you know what proportion of your body consists of human cells versus non-human cells? Any idea? Do you think it's 100%, 50%, 10%, 1%? I'll let you raise your hand. 100%, anyone? 90%? Few? 50%? 10%? 1%? It's about 1%. Most of your body is non-human. Now, there are lots of things in your gut, lots of other cells, but obviously, we as a species, clearly this 1%, which are the human cells, are critical to us, but we're like a coral reef. We have lots of other things, and we don't understand, in general, how all these work together. For a few of my forthcoming slides, I'm very indebted to Dr. Fredericks and Dr. Relman for sharing some of their material and research with me. To summarize Hill's epidemiologic criteria for causal association for a moment, it's a better conceptualization, but it still falls flat for some of the things that we really need to do. But thinking of these concepts does help make sense very often and beginning to think around, just beginning to think. Strength of association, specificity of association, consistency of association, temporality, that particularly is important to me. Does exposure precede the outcome? And the other thing is, if you can do something about it, does it change the pathogen load? Does it change the outcome? And if you think about temporality, it becomes really important when you think of multi-stage, multi-hit processes. You may have something which initiates the cascade and then disappears later on. But you've already had that set up. And so if later on you were to try to find evidence of that organism, say, or factor, it's no longer there. And yet it may have been the primal causal reason initially. So very, very complicated scenarios we have to think about. A biologic gradient, plausibility, does it make sense? And that I have problems with, because very often our knowledge is lacking initially, so what appears not to make any sense initially makes a great deal of sense when we have much more of it figured out. I've seen many instances where we've had new lab tests and they lead us astray initially because we don't fully understand exactly what's going on. In fact, I'll share one example. I reported back in 1987 the first case of a research laboratory worker becoming infected with HIV as a result of occupational exposure. The initial report about that case I withdrew days before the deadline from International Symposium because based on some new lab work using PCR, we thought we had information that showed that in the V3 loop that there is high variation and that this worker's virus variant didn't agree with a lab strain. And so we thought that indeed maybe this worker had not acquired it through the lab. But then in the ensuing weeks, we discovered that in models, we found that in the chimp, we had an evolution of the virus which exactly paralleled what happened in the worker, and that the initial interpretation of the loop data had been entirely wrong, and that indeed it exactly corresponded to what you'd expect. And then when we had the genetic sequencing of the viruses, we found they were the same. And we had clear ironclad proof that indeed that the lab strain was what was in the worker, and we had no evidence that that was a strain that was outside circulating in the rest of the world, so we were pretty confident. And we went along with the history. The worker had no other exposures, no other risk factors, and was a very reliable source, I think, about giving us information. Coherence, experimentation, analogies. So I'm going to talk about something which you'll wonder about why I'm talking about for a moment. Bacterial vaginosis, or BV. It's the most common cause of vaginal discharge worldwide. It's linked, and you notice I use just the word linked. I don't say it's causally, because we don't know that much yet. But it's linked to serious public health consequences, including preterm birth, postoperative infections, and the acquisition and transmission of some STDs. The prevalence is about between a quarter and a little over a third of women who attend clinics for the treatment of sexually transmitted infections. It's twice as common in U.S. African-American women compared to white women. It's often asymptomatic. So unless you do some specific searching and screening, you don't know about it. And look what I just said. Maybe this is part of the reason for our decreased life expectancy in the U.S. Because we know that a big decrement in the U.S. life expectancy is actually because we have some places and some people who have very high rates of adverse birth outcomes. And BV has been associated with many complications. By the way, why do we call it vaginosis? Well, because it's not associated with vaginal inflammation. Indeed, if you see more than one white blood cell in a high-powered field microscope, then that's a sign of inflammation, and you probably don't have bacterial vaginosis. So it's been associated with second trimester miscarriage, pelvic inflammatory disease, preterm birth. You know, preterm birth is associated with small birth rates associated with increased infant mortality. And when you have a young baby die at birth, the number of years of life lost is tremendous. Preterm premature rupture of the membranes, chorioamnionitis, postpartum endometriitis, postoperative infection after GYN surgery, and perhaps earlier acquisition of HIV. Despite extensive study of the altered vaginal bacterial environment associated with BV, its etiology remains unclear, as you'll see in a moment. The specific pathogen or pathogens that cause BV are in question. Whether it's even a sexually transmitted disease is now controversial. Answers are needed to improve the diagnosis, treatment, and prevention of this disease. Furthermore, adequate management and prevention of BV is a prerequisite for avoiding its important associated public health consequences. So this is really a worldwide huge problem, and there have been thousands of studies about BV, and we're making a lot of progress. The fact that we have new questions out there is really a sign that we're beginning to get our hands around it a little bit. So the pathophysiology, there are two competing models. One model is the lactobacillus depletion model. You get an insult. You have a decrease in lactobacilli. You have an overgrowth of other organisms leading to BV. Another possibility is that you have entry of other pathogens. They displace the lactobacilli leading to BV. So what is the order of events? And what you do about it obviously bears importance on this and the reoccurrence. So is BV caused by a disappearance or is it the appearance of other bacteria? So some of the work that's been done over the years now is looking at bacteria and a new classification system based on 16S ribosomal DNA. And in this large group, there's something called TM7. It's one of 36 bacterial divisions. And what's interesting about TM7, it consists of a whole variety of different looking stuff, and there's not a single cultivated representative. It was originally detected in German peat bog. That's where the TM comes from the German. And it was in the middle layers, number 7 of the peat. It's detected in a huge number of different types of sources, such as soil, freshwater, seawater, hot springs, mouse feces, termite gut, sludge in the human mouth. And we think it may be associated with periodontitis and bad breath. If we look at BV, it looks like there is a huge increase in the presence of TM7 with an odds ratio by PCR findings of 23.1. We've known that for 7 years. So some of our issues. Is it a sexually transmitted disease or an opportunistic infection from endogenous flora or both? With respect to an STD, it's associated with an increased risk with a number of partners. Very few women who have never had intercourse have BV. On the other hand, re-exposure issues lead one to wonder whether it's really being sexually transmitted. And treatment of the male partner, when you think there may be there's a reservoir, well, it seems to have no effect on recurrence. But on the other hand, if a woman regularly uses a barrier such as a condom with intercourse with her partner, then the chance of having a reoccurrence of BV declines. So we're really not quite sure what's going on. And what accounts for the muted inflammatory response in BV? Why don't we have a bigger response, particularly if there's this whole panoply of different agents involved? Should we be treating pregnant women with BV to reduce the rates of premature labor? And what accounts for the discrepant results in some antibiotic trials? One of the treatments for BV is trimethoprim sulfur, and the CDC over the years has now changed its stance and said that, yes, it looks like on the basis of controlled studies that it's safe to give women even in the first trimester. There had been some initial concern about whether there would be effects on the fetus, but it looks like we probably should treat. And does treatment for BV reduce the rate of HIV acquisition in women or transmission to sex partners? We really need some randomized controlled trials to give us better evidence about that. So you can see we as epidemiologists have an important role to play. If you look through PCR, this is a really complex slide. Just to give you an inkling, if you have here at the top, you see evidence of patients without BV and the distribution of organisms, and those patients with BV, you see a different distribution of organisms, a very, very wide difference in what is seen. We don't understand which are the key elements. In fact, it may be that you need to have a grouping. So the hypothesis are that BV is a syndrome produced by communities of syntrophic vaginal bacteria, including many species that cannot be isolated in pure culture. It defies the traditional application of Koch postulates. The alternative, BV occurs when different critical species located in extravaginal mucosal sites are transferred to the vaginal niche, where they form a metabolically interdependent community. BV is both an endogenous and a sexually transmitted disease from that point, and necessary members of the community may not be present in any single extravaginal niche. So what is the cause? We obviously need some new models to help us think about causality in these types of events. So that's a long example. One very brief example, if you look at human oral flora, there are a huge number of organisms there as well, the majority of which from the ribosomal analyses appear to be things that we have not yet cultured and don't yet know and understand. It's again sort of this coral reef analogy, and what's pathogenic and what's helpful we really don't understand. So let me now progress more generally. Many laboratory investigations focus on studying a single pathway in vitro. Indeed, for many basic scientists, the lab is God. I can tell you, I used to collaborate with Bob Gallo on much of the HIV work, and he really didn't have very much regard for epidemiologists. Luc Montagnier did. And Gallo's view was that epidemic doesn't prove anything. You only have our associations. He said, in the lab, we really find it. We find the agent. We find what the cause is. Well, I tend to disagree with him because often those laboratory analyses, to be good, concentrate on one thing and one thing only, and one pathway only. And we are complex biologic organisms. An intact organism, we have lots of feedback loops, positive and negative feedback loops. We also often have multiple alternative pathways. So when you carefully control your work in vitro and that pathway, and then you go to an organism, sometimes it doesn't work. You get outsmarted. You have bacterial resistance, which occurs, obviously, but even without that, very often there are other ways of getting around it, and so something you thought would work, sometimes it's actually harmful. The other pathways start to take over and actually then become more aggressive and can do more harm. In fact, we're learning right now that much of what we have in disease relates to innate immunity and when it becomes overactive. And so the issue is that we have a system of response, but how do we really control it and keep it at the right level? And we have very gross tools at the moment, but things are improving. So in vivo phenomena may severely deviate from the inferences and expectations based on initial research. And I've had you focused at a moment now at the laboratory, but I think it also applies here in epidemiology. I think some of the recent prominent failures of controlled clinical trials are an example, and people want to throw those trials out. I think that's wrong. I think if they're done well, you believe those trials and try to understand why they didn't achieve the goal, because we do the trials because we think they're going to work, usually. Most of the trials are designed that way. So why not? Well, we had classic examples. You had the Mr. Fit study for cardiovascular disease, and when it was came out and done, there was no significant difference between the intervention arm and the other arm. Well, there it was an interesting thing that happened. We had contamination of control group because everyone in medicine began to believe that these things were important, and most of the controls wound up getting the intervention outside of the trial. And you weren't going to deprive anyone from getting appropriate therapy. We learned a few things from Tuskegee, and we're still learning, but it's really a very difficult problem. So sometimes these trials don't have adequate power. That's the problem in their design. They should be anticipating that they don't have enough power because some things are being done in the community. And sometimes they don't look long enough. Prostate cancer. The PSA test for screening is a terrible test. We know that, but we've had it long enough where we can look some data. And about 2 years ago, we had some articles published in the New England Journal of Medicine and editorials, and they said, screening by PSA doesn't work. Garbage. They didn't know what they were talking about because, first, the trials reported data at 10 years. If you look at what we know from the epidemiology of prostate cancer and early stage disease, by 10 years, virtually no one is going to be dead from prostate cancer. Their time span was wrong. They had to look at 15, 20, 30 years after. You wouldn't expect to find any significant improvement in mortality at 10 years. That was the U.S. study. And also the U.S. study was poorly designed. They had lots of people who were getting PSAs and who were in the control group, so you had absolutely insufficient power as well. Simultaneously published a European study, which also had about 10 years of follow-up data. And they found some efficacy for PSA with a decrease in mortality of about 20%. Well, a few months ago, one of the subsets from that European study from Scandinavia published their results, which had 14 years of follow-up. Now, it's very interesting. If you look at the U.S. data, you look at the European data, and you look at this subset from Scandinavia, they're almost superimposable in a way for what happens up through 10 years. But what's happening is after 10 years, there begins to be a wide divergence. They had 14 years in the Scandinavian study that was just published. They had a 50% decrease in mortality among those who had been screened with PSA. And that's still too short a time. But the trend is clear that we don't have the answer yet. It was too early to dismiss PSA and how it was used, even though it wasn't used, I think, in the best and most optimal way. But that's one of the problems of our research, too. If we're not going to get the answer to 20 years after we've done initiate our study and we've got better tools, how do we evaluate and put that into a reasonable fabric and when we're trying to make public health recommendations? We want to be conservative and know what's correct, but we also don't want to avoid using interventions that look promising. We also have discrepancy of results from when we see cross-sectional and case control and cohort studies, particularly as they compare it to clinical trials, because again, we often may focus on one factor. And think about feedback loops. What if there was some innate regulation, your body knew that a substance was bad for you? Well, your body, knowing that, would try to regulate and perhaps reduce the levels of that substance in your blood or in your tissues. Maybe decrease the mechanisms for absorption or decrease its ability to release. So if you were to measure, it would appear low. But the reason it's low is because it was bad for you. So if you did your analysis and you found substance A was low, you'd say, what I need to do, that's why they all have disease, I'll give a lot more A to these people and I'll make them better. And then you suddenly do the trial and people are worse. Well, so maybe biology has outsmarted us and the way of looking at data was too simplistic. And I think if you look at that model, some of the trials, particularly in nutrition, which were failures, suggest that maybe this is what was happening. And we know that nutrition is a very complex realm. We know as we look at different receptors and absorption and pathways that these are indeed highly regulated. And we know there are also vast differences based upon genetics and in different races. So it shows we have to study different racial and ethnic groups in these studies, and we have to be broader-minded in what types of concepts we look at. And I think you've got to be very careful in taking some types of epidemiologic data from chronic disease when you apply it. It's not the same as when we had some single acute infectious agent which we then could treat with a specific antibiotic and eradicate. We have to consider multifactorial pathways in the entire organism. There are obviously variations in makeup of individuals. In the post-marketing period after drugs are released, a great many more people take them. Okay? You've got much greatly increased power, right? Thus, some rare side effects can only be served after widespread use of a drug. I think that undoubtedly some reflect genetic pathway variations. So, you have to balance benefits and harm, and I think it's much, much more complicated when we do this for populations than for individuals. So we've had some drugs which have been withdrawn from the market because we've had terrible adverse consequences and deaths, but rarely in some people, and then they're taken off the market because we really don't know how to prevent those. We don't know who's susceptible. And instead of doing much research into trying to figure it out, we say, we got to protect everyone, and the FDA says, got to get off the market. So can we accept having varying indications and warnings? It's a lot more burden on the physician and what types of tests we're going to do, but we are already moving towards designer drugs. For instance, in the realm of cancer, we now have some specific forms of cancer where we know we have to do additional tests, and that only when that test is positive should this person get that drug, is there really evidence of much efficacy. Unfortunately, some of those drugs are absurdly expensive right now, and we've got to figure out how to deal with that issue as well. So the FDA and the lawyers tend to be very intolerant on the side effect side, and the U.S. population tends to be intolerant as well because it makes headlines and people get scared. You just heard about coping with fear from Dr. Laporte. Well, we've got to deal with that. Solution, education and dissemination and teaching epidemiology and concepts about public health from the grade school on. And the EPI section, I should let you know, has been very involved in trying to promulgate the increase in education earlier on. And be careful, the devil tends to be in the details. I teach critical analysis of literature to my graduate students, and I tell them to look very carefully at the methodology. There are an incredible number of methodologic errors and biases that exist. We've learned, for instance, in controlled trials that you often need to do an intent to treat analysis. If you don't do that, you've got a bias subset at the end. In most diseases outside of cancer, if people don't understand that, the journals don't understand that. Systems thinking is a buzzword. Processes are complex. Chronic disease are often multifactorial. Global issues are important. Many factors, including geography, politics, culture, and so on. The impact and scope of events can be global. Think about an example you hear in the opening session. Food grown abroad can be, okay, how are you going to have it pathogen-free when very few of the workers there have access to sanitary facilities? In India, the vast majority of the population do not have access, even in India, to sanitary facilities. Almost all of them do have a cell phone. It's amazing. They put fewer than one-third of the deaths worldwide are assigned a cause of death. That means everything we've been describing in this talk is based upon really insufficient data because we don't know in many of the countries of the world how good that data is. And it turns out that relatively few autopsies are done. Okay, their records are incomplete. There's increasing recognition and that chronic diseases are growing in developing countries, but not much attention so far. There is, a few months ago, a special issue in the Annals of Epidemiology on Global Health. Not one article on chronic disease. Although they were, it wasn't an article on HIV, which I, is an infectious disease, but it's also chronic. So I would say that's okay. And the people who wrote the cover editorial on the issue, Tom Quinn and John Sam, they mentioned that, that this is a limitation of this special issue. We've gone a little bit, we have a little bit of time still for our panel discussion. The next symposium that's going to be in this room is from the epidemiology section for the awards. And so we actually can continue going for a little bit longer now for any of you who wish to stay and have a question to ask us. And then we'll be glad to chat with you. If I could ask the panel members to come up to our table.